Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Here we are at, we are here at the kitchen table. We are here live in downtown Ames. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is community radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern. Just off Main Street in Ames, everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. Plus, the Donalon Kitchen show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative connecting you to your local farmers year-round. CSA shares make great gifts for the holidays. Farm to Folk also offers local, hormone-free, and organic meats for the holiday dinner table. More information on a la carte buying and CSA shares at farmtofolk.com.
Yes, it is. So, here we are around the kitchen table, and today on the Donalana Kitchen, let's consider bread. Consider where it comes from, how it's handled. Not way, way before the baker gets it. Somebody has to grow it. Somebody has to mill it.
This sounds like the Little Red Hen story. And who will help me harvest this wheat? Not I. Not I. And who will help me eat this bread? I will.
Very good. We all love bread. We all love bread. And we're going to find out more about local growing, local milling, and local baking of bread. We're going to visit with Nate Kemperman, Baker Nate Kemperman, and take a trip to Early Morning Harvest Farm. But first, I have a recipe book and a recipe I would like to share. And I think it's kind of appropriate. The whole thing ends up on two slices of bread. The recipe book is a big, big book. The author is Nigel Slater.
A fine Englishman and good food writer.
I love books that have great pictures and have great inspiration, and he's a great writer. He's fun. I pull it out this time of year because this is a winter recipe book. It's called Tender, Volume 1.
It's a huge book.
Huge, huge. It's your doorstop.
Nigel has a lot to say about food.
Right. So it's called Tender, Volume 1, 400 Recipes from the Cook's Garden. There's Nigel Slater is, like Donna mentioned, is a English writer of a lot of food books. He's written Real Fast Food, Appetite, The Kitchen Diaries, and his most latest memoir is Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger. That's won lots of
right,
awards.
Right, and that's not a recipe book. It's wonderful to read.
Good, good.
Might make a good Christmas gift, as a matter of fact.
Oh, we're thinking about things.
Oh, yes.
This recipe book, like I said, is huge, and I'm flipping through it, and it's got great pictures. And I came across a page that kind of caught my eye, and I had to read this recipe because I thought, oh, I didn't know that. And here it is. The recipe is called an onion rabbit.
This is sort of like the Velveteen Rabbit?
Well, I read further, and it has nothing to do with the little bunnies with the ears. No, no, no. This rabbit is sort of in the line of the Welsh rare bit, which has nothing to do with rabbits either.
That's what I thought, right.
It has nothing to do with meat or rabbits.
It's closer to fondue, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have no idea why they call it a rabbit.
Oh,
here
because
it is.
Those British, you know, that they're always using language in a way that we Americans can't quite follow.
So it must be code for something. But
rare bit, I think.
Yeah, rare bit. But this is just spelled and
rabbit,
it says
yeah.
rabbit. And it says onion rabbit. And I always perk up when I hear things about onions. And here's what Nigel Slater has to say about onion rabbit. Of all the hot snacks I knock together, it is this unctuous topping of onions, thick toast, and highly seasoned melted cheese that pleases us the most. The onions need to be left to cook with occasional stir as you pass for a good 15 minutes. Do not cut corners here. And start out with a good bottle of beer. It's part of the recipe. And the leftover beer solves the problem of what to do when you need something to drink with your meal. The onion rabbit recipe is this. 2 small to medium onions, a large dab of butter, 150 grams of cheddar, some, I don't know how much it is, plain flour, 1 heaped tablespoon, 1/2 cup of dark beer, I like dark beer, 1/4 cup milk, English mustard, 2 teaspoons.
And that's the dry stuff.
The dry stuff.
Yes.
Okay, yes. And thick slices of brown bread.
This is where the bread part comes
in. Oh, yes. Peel the onions. Cut them into rings. Let them cook slowly over a low to moderate heat for 15 minutes till they are soft, sweet, and pale gold. When the onions are softening, grate the cheese. Stir the flour into the onions with a wooden spoon. Let the mixture cook gently for a few minutes and slowly stir in the beer, followed by the milk. You should have a thick sauce. Stir in the mustard and a grinding of black pepper and then introduce the grated cheese. Toast the bread lightly on both sides on a baking sheet. Spoon over the rabbit mixture and leave under the grill for a few minutes till the crust is scorched here and there. So we're having that hot cheese.
Yeah,
yay.
You could probably put it in the broiler in the oven or...
Good bread. That was a... recipe for onion rabbit by...
That was really cheesy, Lana.
Yeah, that was good. Mm-hmm. By Nigel Slater, a fine English writer and good hand in the kitchen.
So we are welcoming into the studio today Nate Kimperman. And we're going to talk about... Nate is introducing the store-made, locally-made bread program at Wheatsfield, which will be coming soon to be available. Right, Nate? When are we going to have this wonderful bread?
Well, for sure, soon.
Oh, come on. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting.
Anyway, we're very excited about it.
And this week, do you think? You had said the 13th, but are we now moving away from that?
Yeah, it's involved with the expansion of numerous expansion construction projects at Wheatsfield. So kind of waiting to make sure that we have all our ducks in a row.
You're waiting for the bread racks, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because you now have the new marvelous, amazing oven. I was given a kitchen tour last week, and it's
a very nice deck oven built in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, by American Baking Systems.
Wow.
High quality, versatile.
Good.
What do you look for in a bread oven? Why is that different from a oven at home? This is
yeah, tell us what a deck oven is.
Yeah, a deck oven, yes.
A deck oven is where you have heat coming into this oven and heating up stones, like a pizza stone, but they're very large. And you have a lot of heat that's going to be absorbed by those stones and then issued into whatever you're baking. And
so it's a very radiant heat.
It's very radiant heat. Uh-huh. You can preserve a lot of moisture. That way you get a lot of initial flush of heat, which for the style of bread we're going to be producing is very important.
Now, is there some steam component?
And then the steam component of the oven is that each oven chamber can have steam produced in it for the initial part of the bake.
So you're getting immense radiant heat that probably can go to quite high temperatures. Like, do you bake at 500? What do you do?
I think this oven has a 550-degree limit, mm-hmm. upper limit. But that really is going to depend on your stones, the type of stones that you have.
What are the stones made
ovens,
out of?
They're a composite of some sort. Mm-hmm. These are, I don't know exactly.
Oh, okay.
There's a variety of stones
some
available.
Some special thermal qualities. And then you can control the humidity as well. Because I noticed it has a big reverse osmosis system on it and this, that, and the other to make everything just perfect.
To be exact, the reverse osmosis system is going to be used elsewhere in the store. This oven actually does better without reverse osmosis, but it has its own filter on it.
Oh, I did see that next to it. So this deck oven, just to give people, what is it, about 7 feet high? And it's a square that's maybe, I don't know, is it 5 feet by 5 feet, 4 feet by, it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, it's pretty large.
Yeah. And how many chambers, separate chambers?
That's three separate chambers that each can have a different temperature in them. And that relates to the versatility that I mentioned. Because we'll also be, in addition to bread, we'll be doing all our other baked goods in there
the
as well.
The sweet goody things.
Yeah.
Which we're used to. But this addition of locally made bread is it's pretty stunning. Because we're also having locally grown wheat, which is also locally milled. Now, this is not it's a rare set of circumstances, I would say. There are not that many communities our size that actually have all of these options available. So we will actually be touring and talking with Earl, our locally grown wheat and miller. But first, Nate, tell us how you got into baking. So how did you learn all these fancy tricks?
Well, it started way back when I was in high school. I learned from my mom. She's a baker in
Decorah,
Iowa.
Right.
And she's a market baker up there. And I just always liked to hang out in the kitchen and help her and kind of got to know and appreciate what fresh bread can be. And it was an integral part of our growing up. And we never realized how special it was.
Like all children.
We just knew it was good and we ate a lot of it. And then I guess there's two components to it. When I was a senior in high school, there was a science fair project. And I'd always been, you know, bread's fascinating to watch it rise and wonder the dough and wonder what the heck is going on. Why is it doing that? And so as a science fair project, actually, I, with my mom's help, kind of in parceling out what the different parts of the dough could be having an effect on the rise. I tried to isolate the different ingredients and their effect on yeast action as a science fair experiment. So I got to really know, even before I learned how to bake, that, oh boy, you know, salt affects the yeast action. Sugar affects yeast action. Fats might or might not. These sort of things. Like
time and temperature.
What's going, yeah. Time and temperature, yes. So those all things started to gain me a fascination of the process. And then after I graduated from high school, I was looking for what should I do for work before I head to college, a job or something like that. And again, my mom suggested, well, I could use a break from baking. Why don't you take over that part of the business this summer? And so she showed me the ropes and got me started. And then I made the bread that summer and sold it at farmer's market for a summer job. And that really...
Wow.
Really brought me up to speed quickly and
good
not
for your
only
mom,
the ins and outs.
Right?
Yes, I owe so much to her for this this passion and vocation that I've had the rest of my life.
And then you went off to Grinnell, right?
I did go to Grinnell.
Did you do any baking at Grinnell?
I tried to in our little college dorm kitchens and such. And I returned to Cora to do the summer baking again, two more summers.
Oh.
So...
So enhancing your skill set as you went along, and then you...
After college, I cooked, actually, at restaurants and daycare centers and
really
explored
the cooking.
Really put
that college
cooking.
Degree to good use, I guess, huh?
Well, the way I look at it, I was baking before I went to college, and college added to my perspective and depth of understanding the world, but I kind of always knew in my heart that I was going to be... doing working with my hands.
Well, you must have, did you study something about food systems or rural sociology or anything like that?
I say my vocational skills were learned on the job almost entirely. I did quite a bit of reading and I always like to talk to bakers and learn from whoever I can. But it's a very hands-on type of learning and experience.
Yes, it is.
So,
yes, it is.
My degree in anthropology, I think I was attracted to anthropology just because it is a study of culture. And I feel like the things I'm passionate about, music and bread and farming and those type of things.
Oh, right. We didn't mention this, but Nate is also a farmer. He and his partner, Alice McGarry, have Mustard Seed Farm.
Yeah, that's right.
Which contributes a lot in Ames.
Yeah, we're a community farm, all volunteer. We try to grow a lot of food to share with.
You're a Catholic workers farm?
Catholic worker farm.
Uh-huh.
It'll be our 10th year this year. So we've really evolved a lot every year, learned a lot, worked with a lot of different people.
Brave beginning farmers.
Yeah, we can't call ourselves that too much more. It won't be an excuse very much longer.
On Mustard Seed Farm, do you have a bread oven out there? Do you do things like that?
3 years ago, we built a clay oven for baking pizza in. And you could probably do one or two loaves. Yeah, wood fired in it as well. So, and I've worked with interns the last few years and making some pizzas and making some doughs and seeing what it's like baking in that kind of oven and just making bread from scratch. So I've always loved making bread at home, and I really encourage people to do it, even though I'm a professional baker and have been now for a dozen years cooking.
It's not the first time you'll have tasted Nate's bread in Ames. He baked at the cafe for a long time.
Yeah, for 7 years, and I did an apprenticeship at a artisan bakery in Columbia, Missouri for 2 years before that, Uprise Bakery, where I really learned a lot of good chops working overnight shift on my own. And before that, I worked 2 years at a Great Harvest Bakery in Minnesota, which really gained me an appreciation for the whole process of milling, because Great Harvest Bakeries buy the wheat berries in.
Oh, they do their own milling.
Yeah, and the wheat is grown specified to their characteristics they want. Mm-hmm. It's very, very, very enlightening to be a part of, to be able to see those wheat berries come in and turn into bread in the course of several days. And to be able to see all the aspects of that as well. So
What are the differences between buying already prepared flour or making your own flour?
Especially in Great Harvest, for those bakers that like to use a lot of whole grains, whole grain flour, it's a little bit of a different beast than white flour. If you're using whole wheat flours, the oils in the germ, which are preserved in the flour, can start to go rancid fairly quickly.
They're more volatile.
Exactly, yeah.
But they're also really healthy if you eat them away.
For sure. It's a very healthy way to go if you can get it. If you can manage it to make the bread as soon after milling as you can.
So we have a little advantage with being able to use the locally grown, locally milled flour right here from Earl
Absolutely.
Hafner.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So Nate, since you won't tell us exactly when we might be able to buy the bread, sometime in the very near future, at least give us an idea of what kind of bread you're going to start with. I'm assuming you're going to start with a few basics, and then as things get more in a flow, you can add fancier things in. But what are we starting with? What are we going to be able to buy for the Christmas holidays?
We'll have some baguettes, ciabatta, sourdough, and a possible variety of different specialty breads. We're still kind of in discussion about how that's going to work and which ones will be offered when and what kind of schedule to have. But among those specialty breads will be a multigrain and cranberry walnut.
Well, that'll be good for the holidays.
An olive.
Olive bread. Oh, now, and the sourdough, will that be in a boule shape?
It'll probably be in a little bit of an oval shape.
Oval, okay.
Mm-hmm. We'll have other ones. Donna said boule shape. That basically just means a round loaf.
A big round one.
Yeah.
So, but yours will be more like a little football shape.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And I like the football shapes.
Mm-hmm.
French here. The football shape. It's a nice shape because your slices are more uniform across.
That's true. It's a little more manageable.
It's easier to slice on your own because we don't have a bread slicer yet at the store. So you'll have to slice it yourself.
Yes, so everybody be getting your serrated bread knives ready.
Yeah. And be careful.
Be careful.
Yeah.
I've baked a little bit at home. You put a lot of care into this one little loaf. But as a professional baker, give us an idea of what sort of quantity for how many loaves do you think of at a time when you bake?
It's hard for me to say that. I'd love to impress you by some fancy numbers, but I don't really think about it that way. I think about it in terms of proportions. So a dough has a certain proportion, and bakers use a certain type of special math. It's called baker's math, where you determine the amount of other ingredients based off of the flour. So you always know, like, you can look at a formula right away and know this is a wetter dough, this is a drier dough. Is the salt and the yeast an appropriate amount. Why would there be more salt or yeast in this recipe?
Is this based on, like, the protein content or the moisture or the what in the flour?
Or the style of bread. For instance, ciabatta and bega are very similar doughs. Ciabatta is an Italian, basic Italian white bread. French is the bega is a basic French white bread using white flours. And they're usually crusty and light inside.
What's the difference in the two recipes?
Well, a bega is going to be anywhere between mid-60% water to flour. So, again, flour is going to be 100% and considered 100%. Mm-hmm. And then so water is going to be 66% of that. So if you have 100 grams of flour in your recipe, you're going to have 66 grams of water. But ciabatta is going to be like maybe the same flour. Well, you're going to up that water percentage into the 70s. So you're going to have bigger holes.
Oh, so only 10% more difference in the ciabatta. Huh. Moisture.
Yeah, moisture. It'll really depend on the flour and how daring the baker is dealing with wetter doughs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because you are dealing with a living thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Very much. And you're dealing with a living thing over time. Mm-hmm. Is that you started the night before? You started how many? I know it depends on the time, but do you bake in the evening or bake the day before? Or
we'll be making breads that will all have some degree of what's called pre-ferment in them, or a pre-dough, and that really helps the flavor, mm-hmm. keeping quantity, texture,
crust. So they like rest overnight?
The whole dough may or not, but for us, it's going to be a proportion of the flour will be pre-fermented. Mm-hmm. That can be either in a sourdough starter mm-hmm. type situation or what's called a poulish, which is yeasted, like a yeasted starter. Mm-hmm. And so that lends just a lot more interesting textures and flavors to the doughs. It decreases mixing time. The whole process is pretty fascinating if you get into it, all the different variables you can have. But one of the important things to me is not mixing too long. When you start to mix too long, you oxidize the flours, which decreases the nutritional quality, color, and nutrition of the doughs.
So are you going to use some sourdoughs, wild yeasted yeast? What are you going to be doing?
Yeah, we'll use some wild yeast or sourdough starters as well as.
Is this stuff that you've cultivated yourself?
Yeah.
You have your own private starter that you're going to.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
But starters are fascinating to me. So mm-hmm. I like using them.
So which ones would you be using your personal starters in?
The sourdoughs.
Okay.
But also the other breads, too, that will have a sourdough component.
Now, okay, so I want to egg you on a little bit more about the numbers. For example, we know you're going to make baguettes. How many baguettes will you make in one batch?
Well, this is also the answer to earlier to Lana's question, too, about how to think about sizes of batches and things. It all depends on the baker's flow of their day, what their bottlenecks are like. Ah. So our bottleneck is going to be our oven, which can only do 8 baguettes at a time per deck. Although our mixer could handle larger batches, we're going to have to be limited to being, no, we can only bake, say, 24 baguettes at a time. Mm-hmm. So if you start to stretch your batch over the number of bakes, you're going to start to really change
How long does a baguette have to be in this super-duper oven?
Baguette bakes are pretty quick, 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, depends on their size and stuff. But I say by 25 minutes, they should be out.
As you can tell, Donna is very anxious to get this stuff on the shelf.
I'm going to be standing at the door, sniffing, waiting for them hot out of the oven.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I want to take a little time here, a little break here, to talk a bit about Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been on the air for, 3 years
coming
now.
Up. Third year anniversary.
Can you believe it?
Three full years.
And also, we are here to remind you that this is a volunteer organization. This is community radio, and we encourage you to become a member of this fine radio station by going to khoifm.org. Find the magic donate button, and on that website, you can find out a lot more about this station.
And we also encourage you to give a gift of KHOI memberships to all those people in your beloved list that have everything else.
Yes. If you know somebody...
It's a one-size-fits-all.
Yes. If you know somebody that would listen to this radio station... Buy them a membership. There's like coffee mugs and things, too. Basic membership is $55, but we encourage you to up that ante a little bit more. We'd appreciate a bigger amount. Find out more on the website. And like I said, if you know somebody that listens to this radio station, they'd love to be a member, get them a membership. And if you know somebody who doesn't listen to this radio station, get them a membership. Boy, will they be surprised.
Yeah, what could be nicer than to the ability that we have in this town to listen to the multiplicity of voices of our own local community?
We do. Not only shows like this one, talk about food and farming and other things, there's lots of other shows on too. So listen, listen, and put your money where your ears are. Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was some Scottish fiddle music, some Strathspeys, played by Scottish fiddler Elka Baker. That was a little bit of Devil in the Kitchen. Oh, I love these names. That was the name of the music. Yes, we are here in the kitchen with Nate Kemperman, and we are celebrating bread today. He's talked a little bit about his bread journey, his baking journey, and what it's going to take to make some things.
Nate is going to be in the very near future. He's not committing to an exact time or date, but I would say hopefully in time to have fresh bread for your Christmas parties and your Christmas table. Nate is the baker at Wheatsfield, and they are rolling out a new in-house bakery.
When you bake for yourself, is there something you like to bake for Christmas? What's your favorite Christmas thing to bake for the holidays?
Oh, probably stolen. Mom always used to make it and put a bunch of frosting on it.
I was hoping you'd really say special. Stolen. Yeah. I do. Explain what stolen is.
It's a sweet bread. Mm-hmm. It's very sweet bread. And it's traditional to be made at holiday times. There's a lot of different, of course, traditions of how it's made. It's usually got like eggs in it. It's rich. It's folded and in possible different ways. Or sometimes people just make a big round loaf as well.
And it has fruits and nuts in it, right?
Yeah. And again, those traditions will dictate what those are.
German tradition, basically.
Yeah. And, my mom's kind of preference in not liking pectin, like fruit pectin type thing. But that is pretty traditional in some cases. Usually she just used dried fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe raisins and raisins.
Well, actually, Lon and I...
nuts.
We just talked about, of course, making your own candied orange peels and putting those things. So stolen is, I would say, it's related to fruitcake, but it's lighter. It's not something that you have to make so far in advance. And maybe by next Christmas, a year from now, maybe we can talk Nate into making stolens to sell at Wheatsfield.
It really does remind me of a holiday sort of gathering, because it's the kind of thing that goes really well with coffee. It's just a really nice thing. And I remember my family always used to get a stolen from the lady that lived next door. And it would come, and she always made it in the shape of a candy cane with some stripies on it. Stolen. That's S-T-O-L-L-E-N. And I think there's some umlauts in there someplace or other, too. Stolen, yes. Well, back to Nate here. Nate the baker. And we're glad that you are here in town baking for us. You and Donna recently took a field trip. Tell us about where you went.
Yeah, we had a little road trip. Nate and I drove over to Panora to visit with Earl Hafner, who has early morning harvest. And that is that means we have our very own miller. So it's about an hour from Ames, a little more. And so, Nate, you want to just add a little bit of your impressions about going to visit Earl and how that's influencing the kinds of breads that you're going to bake at Wheatsfield?
Sure. It's a family farm.
Oh, yeah.
His son, Jeff. And their approach to farming is organic, so they don't like using chemicals and trying to commit to a sustainable type growing system, which was very important to the future of the land in Iowa and to the quality of food that is produced now and to the quality of life of those who are producing it. The big picture stuff here.
Yeah, he has multiple grains. They have cows. They have chickens. And I was giving Earl a hard time about singing to his cows. I've heard him sing to the cows. It's lovely. The reason he thinks that his protein is high in his wheat is because they foliar feed the...
Yeah, they're able to grow a grain that's would otherwise be a little more challenging to grow here, which would be spring wheat, which is planted in the spring. You know, more commonly would be a winter wheat. They're able to do that with the help of this special fertilizer feeding, all connected with their system on the farm. So it's very unique, and we're just really blessed and lucky to have.
Let's take a visit to Earl's farm. That's early morning harvest. And we start out this visit with Donna talking to Earl about cornmeal.
So the cornmeal, to me, I can take regular cornmeal and I can run it.
So that's how you get, like, I buy the grits because I like them big like that.
Well, the polenta, I have a different machine for that.
Oh, but is that what I'm buying? The bigger?
Polenta is the larger grind. When we first started, all the chefs said, well, we want the grits to be bigger for more texture. You know, so I got this corn cutter and made it bigger. But then they complained it takes too long to cook.
Well, those chefs, Earl, you can never please them.
Well, that's when we designated the difference between polenta and grit.
Okay, so the largest grind, the biggest pieces are you're calling polenta. Then the next one is grits, then cornmeal. And then do you do corn flour also?
Yeah.
So four different gradations.
Yeah. And actually, when we do the corn cereal, it's a third. It's a smaller than the grits. Just a little bit.
For your cornmeal mush in the morning.
Oh, like boy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Now, what are you growing yourself besides it's all your corn, right?
Yeah.
And which wheats are you growing?
The Heart Red Spring is all we grew this year.
Okay.
Really?
Soft wheat. So this year we planted our own soft wheat.
Then an Iowa Century goal is winter wheat, right?
Well, it's winter wheat, but...
Winter wheat.
The hard winter wheat was from here north.
Right.
Mostly it's the soft winter wheat.
Here, south. Right, okay.
Okay, now the soft ones are the ones you need for all the pastry flours, right?
Yeah. For the general purpose.
Mm-hmm. So you're gonna try to grow your own soft wheat?
Right.
Is it in the ground already?
Yes.
Did it come up?
Not yet. So, you know, this inventory here, it's more the larger products. This extra fine.
Oh, you've got it extra fine.
Well,
it's almost like in the South they call it bolted. It goes through such a fine.
Well, everybody.
Who wanted it? What are you using it for?
Everybody's down there in.
They wanted
Fairfield,
it?
The store.
Uh huh. I think Anson Mills even uses it. You know what you can do? Look on the Anson Mills site and read about their bolted. And I think it's the same because their bolted means it's sifted through a pretty fine cloth, actually, to get it to that. Like, I think there's a biscuit recipe, for example, that's like pure cream and this flour.
Hawk down in Des Moines, HOQ restaurant.
Oh,
he uses it for non-bread.
Oh.
In the summertime, he goes takes the non-resin farmer's market, and he probably extra fine.
Oh, okay. And the bread, extra fine bread.
Well, then he'll switch to general purpose. You know, and we never know what he's going to get. You know, so
making that up in cost.
You price it in.
Well, I do. I charge him an extra 10%. But in the sifters, you see, you take off the extra fine, and then you can put in a 60 mesh, which is your standard flour. And so then you have a separate barrel of straight 60 mesh. So it is coarser. And I have to turn around and I blend that in, like Bakehouse. I blend it in at 1%.
Buckwheat, rye, whole wheat pastry. This is my favorite baby here. Bread flour, whole wheat flour, pastry, cornmeal. Winter hard.
I see there's like 8 barrels empty out there, so they just. I know they had a big order for dark rye or whole rye.
That's what this one is?
This is regular white flour.
White rye.
So what's dark rye?
Well, you know what whole wheat is. This is whole rye.
Whole rye.
Okay. The dark rye is whole rye.
Yeah. Yes. Whoever coined it dark rye, I don't know.
This is dark rye, but it's white.
No, this is light rye.
You've taken the...
The hull out of it.
Yeah.
That's it. So this still has the germ in it, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It won't look like white flour. Right. White rye. You can't get a white rye, can you?
That's as white as it gets.
Yep.
Pretty. Now you don't bleach anything, do you?
No.
Let's see what the buckwheat looks like. This was Earl's first baby.
That's pretty fine.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Woo. But there again, that's a 60 mesh. Yeah. You know, so when you want crepes or something, it's got to go.
It's gotta,
90 mesh.
Oh, wow.
That's what the extra fine is 90 mesh.
That's with the hulls, right? This is whole buckwheat. It's pretty light.
Well, the finer the screen, the more of the hulls you're going to take. Yeah. That's the biggest advantage of going to your extra fine.
So it gives you that color and that much more fiber, too.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in the bagging room now.
This is dark. Okay, there's your... That's what you get, polenta.
Yeah, I got a big stash of that.
Versus the grits.
Yep, I like them big. That's the one I fed to Dan Barber, and he just blew his mind and said, Dan, I can't get this out at my restaurant. And I'm going, well, you know, we do grow a lot of corn in Iowa. This is the best stuff. Now, is this refrigerated, or are you just able to keep it?
Well, it's on the same air conditioning as the mill.
Now, you know Earl has honey, too. Have you seen his buckwheat?
Yeah, honey, too.
Oh, yeah. Look at this buckwheat.
Wow, look at that.
Have you not tasted Earl's buckwheat?
I have.
You know, we got zero buckwheat honey off of the field this year.
Wow.
I don't know. 2012 is the same way.
Oh, no. So where's this from?
That's still last year.
Well, I have to take a jar of this home, too. Earl says it gets rid of arthritis, right?
Well, it helps my hands. You must have heard me tell the story, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, well, there was a guy that came in here in the middle of the day one day. He says, I got to have 3 jars of buckwheat honey. The doctor says, I have to take it for my hemorrhoids. And I thought, do you lick your fingers after you put it on, or do you? I didn't say that, but it sure went through my mind. That's all. But he meant he was having digestive problems, and honey is...
General purpose.
I don't imagine most of the extra fine goes out in 25 to 50 pound bags. Well, we can put some in.
Okay.
No, Earl, on your general purpose, are you blending that then? Are you blending it with soft and hard?
Yeah,
meats?
It's a third soft, and it started out with a 50-50, and it was actually wheat fields that somebody complained, and.
Now you had a question, Nate, about. Protein percentages.
Yeah. Well, the reason that I like using AP for, like, Heartland Mills AP is around, I haven't looked at, the lots vary, but it's in like 11 to 12% range.
Yeah.
And it's better for baguettes and ciabatta and that kind of stuff. But I don't know if that's all a blend of hard wheats.
Actually,
or if they're blending any soft wheats in, I don't know that.
So our soft wheat's like 10%.
Uh-huh. And your hard is 14. Yeah. So and a half. Wouldn't that do it?
But there's a difference in between hard and soft wheat.
Yeah,
it's
a totally different starch. So from what I researched when we started, the poorer quality flour is 10 to 12%. Of what you buy in a grocery store.
Oh, that means
most of it is.
You're just too good, huh?
Well, we pushed for a higher quality bread flour,
and that's based on the kind of seed variety that you actually grow.
Yeah, and then
So it's also cleaner, healthier wheat.
Yeah. So a lot of times, especially on organics, you're short nitrogen. And,
so what are you doing to get your nitrogen up?
We foliar feed.
Really?
With fish, liquid fish.
Oh, huh. Okay, so, Nate, knowing that, does that mean you could learn to work with higher protein wheat?
Again, it's like what bread's appropriate for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a nice, like, creamy, big hold baguette or ciabatta style bread. Like the European bread flour, their European bread flours are all lower proteins, but there's so many different varieties of wheat and so many kinds of wheat that it's not necessarily, protein's not going to tell you everything. So it's a matter of learning what Earl's wheat is best for, what bread would it best perform in.
Oh!
So like.
Good, so that could more dictate the kinds of breads that you make. Because this is what's available.
Well, that's true. I mean, if I can't make the baguette, I just want to use Earl's flour, and there's a big demand for that, I'm not going to make an inferior baguette, or I'll have to make a different kind of baguette with 14% hard red spring wheat, you know, flour.
But are they doing this at New Pie? They're making baguettes.
I don't like their baguettes at New Pie. Uh-huh. I'm picky about baguette. So. Okay. But yeah, and you're using
very crusty.
You're using like pre-ferments, the flavor of the flour has to be very good too. The flavor itself of the flour, because you're not adding any honey. It's just flour and water.
Okay.
And you develop the flavor through fermentation.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different approach to the flour. But I'm not saying that. Like, I'm going to be really curious to see what your how your soft winter wheat does. I'd be really curious down the road to get a hard winter wheat variety to use for baguettes and ciabatta.
Well, see, I used to use a hard winter variety called Arapaho.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't get a consistent protein with it.
Yeah.
But we have learned since then that the foliar feed and better agronomic practices, you know.
You learned that with the hard spring.
Well, we just learned over years of experience. Also learned that this hard red spring that we have is probably the best milling quality that we have. I mean, I look for efficiency, you know. So the amount of flour I get from a bushel.
That consistency of the bran, right? And
well,
is that what it is?
I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
It's like our wheat this year is very good milling quality, better than last year's. It doesn't look any different.
Yeah, well, something in the weather, right?
Well, yeah.
You're doing more and more like the foliar feeding and practices that are going to enhance
Every year is so different. I mean, like going back to oats, this year's oats, I just can't get them. Same variety and everything. I just cannot get a good porridge oat.
So it's just down to the weather.
I don't know. Our oat field got hit like crazy with hail this year. It still yielded. It was down flat. I put peas in with it because peas are supposed to be synergistic to oats. And after the hail hit, you also had a higher percentage of small kernels. And I have to run them through the cleaner to take off the smalls and the peas in order to get up to a food-grade oat. You know, so.
It's more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah. I got the oats contracted. I got if I have 1,100 bushel of, but I'm going to have darn near a semi-load of peas doing that.
You know, pea flour is very big now as an additive. Well, I know a lot of companies are using it in their non-gluten formulations. They bring the protein up with it.
See, I don't know anything about the variety of peas.
They're
brown or...
It's just a field pea, right?
Yeah.
Or cow pea, field pea?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't... Yeah, we don't get varieties on our cover crop peas.
I eat them. They taste like cow feed.
Yeah, cows like them.
Yeah.
So you'll sell them for feed?
No, I'll probably feed them to my calves.
Ah. As a good protein source.
You have some very good looking calves, too.
Oh, down here?
Down here.
Those are the late ones.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering.
You going to give them extra peas because they're smaller?
I'll probably just sell these.
Yeah.
You still sing to your cows?
Yeah, so Harmon says it sounds like you're screaming to me.
No, I've heard him. He's a lovely Irish tenor, and the cows follow him. It's well.
Hard red. Okay, so what's your, do you have a variety? I'm just curious, what's your variety on the hard red spring?
RB07.
It's very romantic sounding.
Yeah. Well,
I like Arapaho.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll be putting that
on the label.
RB07. Is it 07 or 07?
Yeah.
So let's see. Darren told me to talking with Darren, bakery manager, about some price issues with us. But it looks like you're selling into the bulk department at Wheatsville at 80 cents a pound. But the whole wheat pastry flour is not Iowa grown in your current stock.
Right.
Right.
It's northern Missouri.
But it may be in the future.
Right.
Okay.
But it's probably still within your 200-mile radius of Wheatsfield, I would think.
Is it northern Missouri?
Northern Missouri,
it's just over the border. And the reason I buy it from, he lives 20 miles from my brother down there.
Okay.
My brother's at Fairfax, Missouri.
So. Okay. So that works out well.
Yeah.
And the general purpose is blended then with that flour and
right. The
other one. Okay. I have to ask Rhonda then about, Darren's wondering about oat flour prices, because we're getting oat flour in from some distributor right now. Same with cornmeal, corn flour. So I think he'd be interested in, if we were, yeah.
You just have to talk to him, because I really don't know the price structure. You know, you got retail, you got grocery, you got a distributor, you got a wholesale price. And, we didn't realize.
We'll have to negotiate that.
Well, just ask for, your wholesale price.
Okay.
I think that's what wheat fields get.
For their bulk department?
Yeah.
How are you getting it there now?
Yeah,
are you using farm to table?
Well, when we
whatever she's calling it,
whenever we deliver up there, we deliver to wheat fields.
You deliver personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your capacity?
Well, we can use Ellen with Farm Table to deliver also.
Forestry.
But there's 100 stores between Colorado and Minnesota, and you know, all we have to do is deliver to Des Moines, and it goes.
It's a hub from.
Oh, is that NCGA? No. Natural Grocers is...
It's a new store.
Yeah.
Oh. Don't know them.
Kind of store.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're... Because the new corn that we have this year has three times the amount of keratin in it than normal corn does. It's a high vitamin A
corn.
Oh,
and what are you doing with it?
Well, it's still in the bin, drying down.
Oh.
It's a flint corn instead of the other. So hopefully the grits and everything else will be a little more texture.
Oh.
You can't tell before it dries now.
Des Moines Feed and Grain wants to do something.
And this is an organic seed?
Well, I buy it non-GMO.
And then grow it organically.
Yeah. But through the same breeder, I can get high... It takes 6 months to get an answer. And if I could, if there was a demand, I'd grow 10 acres of each to see.
For next summer.
Yeah. So, you know, but each area of the country has a different culture different demand.
Right. We're not exactly tortilla country. Although, more...
We have a lot of people come and buy the corn flour.
So it could... Can you make masa? It can be... What's that word? Nixtamalized or...
Well, the one... There's two varieties that are good for the masa.
Ah.
You know? So you have a high Mexican area like Marshalltown or something, you see. You could go...
Well, you know, Earl, really, truly, grits are also lime processed.
Hominy?
Yeah, hominy is, too. And that's a not a Mexican, that's a southern thing.
Yeah.
So
we had probably 50 kids from the World Food Prize come through here. And we were standing here, you know, and it's tough to make conversations with all these. Because I put up difference between grits and polenta and explained the difference in the cultures. And
Farmers like them, so close by and so committed to that.
And the fact that they set up a whole milling production system, which right is there, no yeah. small investment in terms of just farm assets, and certainly a great deal of time is put into this.
Yep, and knowledge acquisition mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And to be able to have the fresh grain grown there. Well, it's not technically fresh. There is a drying process the grain has to go through after post-harvest. But fresh as it could be coming
fresh,
off there.
But it is freshly milled.
It's freshly milled, right, yes. Once it's milled, it goes out. It goes out to stores and bakeries. And that's just really, really exciting to have him involved and to have them involved.
Yeah, and you can actually buy the grains in yourself, the bulk bin,
yes,
right?
Yes, you can, yep.
At Wheatsfield mm-hmm. and probably some other places around town that I'm mm-hmm. not aware of. But
yeah, Don has always talked about the cornmeal and the polenta from there.
Oh, we've had a lot about Earl's polenta on one of my favorite things.
Oh, that's very
and buckwheat. He does buckwheat, too. Love the buckwheat. Are you going to be able to bake anything with buckwheat in it?
Well, the multigrain bread formula will have... We'll have buckwheat as part of the cereal mix.
Yippee.
And testing that bread out, the buckwheat really comes through nicely.
I'm
really happy with that buckwheat flavor. And I've always really been a big fan of buckwheat. It'll be part of the kind of taste. It won't be exclusive because there's a lot of other grains going on in that. But mm-hmm. that'll be the multigrain bread. I'm shooting for being 100% Iowa grown.
And milled grains. So you'll do, what grains are you going to put in the multigrain then?
Well, in addition to Earl's cereal mix, which has wheat, rye, and buckwheat, and corn.
That's right. He grows all of those things.
We'll also add in his oat flour.
Mm-hmm.
And there's flax that's grown in Iowa, in Carroll.
Oh.
The Barrens. And we'll be using that flax in that as well. So it'd be like I'm lost count already. Six grains, I think.
At the
six
very
Iowa
least.
Grains.
Oh, sounds yummy.
So let's look forward to some really good bread. Thanks to Nate Kepperman for joining us in the studio today.
Yes, and we'll be even more thankful when we get our hands on some of that bread.
Patience, Donna, patience.
Baker
it's coming.
At Wheatsfield, Nate Kepperman. Thank you, Nate.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You've heard Scottish music by Elka Baker, but we'll go out with more fiddle tunes, another fiddle tune here. It's called The Snowy Path by fiddler Jason Huntley. Jason Huntley is a past Ames resident, a fine dance band fiddler. He used to play for the contra dances here in town with the Barn Owl Band, but he graduated from ISU and went off to bigger things. And this is from a CD of his called Shift, and the music is called Snowy Path. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen every Tuesday at noon here on your community radio station. We are going to be taking a break, so you'll be hearing some reheated and rerun and much loved shows from our archives, so keep listening on this radio station.
Lana's going to go into hibernation for a month or so during January, and I'm off to New Zealand to see my only grandchild, so you think of me on the beach there.
KHOIFM.org and push the magic donate button. Memberships make a great Christmas gift. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Evan Taylor.
And happy holidays to all of you.
Eat good food and enjoy life.